Well, given that gift that you just offered us, why don't we take off from here? Let's start with a little meditation, if you will. I invite you to close your eyes and think about the last beautiful and warm fire that you were privileged to be sitting around, one that made you feel good. Were you in your living room, in your home, safe and warm on a cold night, like I was this week by the wood stove? Were you camping with some friends? Were you showing the wonders of fire to perhaps a young person? Anyway, bring that image to mind of you and the warmth of fire and bask in it just for a few moments. And now, as you have that image of your warm fire in your mind, think about how you're feeling by that memory of fire. And take a deep breath, and if you've opened your eyes, if you'd closed your eyes, please open them. I'll return to that image of fire in a few moments. You know, when I was first invited to speak here today, I was told that the theme was going to be abundance. And so later, when I was corrected and told it was more about balance, I thought, well, how can I massage that abundance sermon into the balance sermon? But, you know, I'm an experienced minister, and I think I've made that work. So it's hopefully that will work out. I've entitled this sermon, Balancing for Personal and Planetary Transformation. And as I said, I am a bit nervous here today. I talked about some of the amazing people that I'm in awe of who are here in the room with me. Actually, all of you, in fact. But also, I'm a bit nervous because I feel like these are some of the most important ideas I've ever had to preach about. And I'm worried that I'm not going to get it right. But I'm going to try because I think we need a revolution in balance. A revolution that would bring about personal and planetary transformation. But balance. Life is a balance, we are told. Between good and bad, and darkness and light, and yin and yang, right and left. Well, that's probably true. It doesn't really tell us where that balance point should be, where that stone on the corner of your order of service should be. And in fact, where it should be maybe really only makes sense when you know the opposite magnitude of what it is you're trying to balance. The balance point is an equilibrium we are trying to achieve. In science, we speak of equilibrium or even inertia. Things are held in equilibrium until some force comes along and rips through the homeostasis. If the force is large enough, perhaps a new balance is achieved. But if not, an old equilibrium returns. Equilibrium returns and inertia has triumphed. In the context of our worship theme, I think we're really talking about equanimity, about a sort of personal peace. And whence our equanimity when life comes at us and we lose our balance? How can we best return to equilibrium or find a new equilibrium? How can we find equanimity again? And not only that, but true satisfaction, contentment, joy, And what is it that threw us off balance in the first place? I think I could really sum up the sermon that I'm going to give in just 7 words. And it would be something like, well, feeling good is better than feeling bad. And I know you're kind of disappointed that you got up early on daylight saving time morning to come hear me say that, but bear with me. Stay with me a little bit. It gets deeper than that. I think we are sometimes at a loss to understand how important it is that we do seek to feel truly good, that we do seek to reestablish balance. We certainly don't think about the ramifications of why that's important. We are, of course, taught to be good and selfless people, as I know that really each and every one of you in this room are. And yet, as part of being good and selfless, perhaps sometimes we think that we shouldn't focus on our own balance or our own well-being. What I'm going to get into today is talking about how imperative it is that we do everything in our power to do so. This domain of feeling good is a relatively new focus. Some of you are no doubt familiar with the field of positive psychology. Rather than focusing, as so much of the science of psychology did during the 20th century, rather than focusing on how humans come to be mentally unhealthy or even impaired, positive psychology studies how it is that people are robust. How do we maintain happiness in spite of all odds? How are we resilient? What is it that gives us true joy and satisfaction? Not just merely passing hedonic pleasure, as we get often if we buy something new or feel something pleasurable. What is it that gives us deep satisfaction? And this is what the science of positive psychology for the past 20 years has been trying to uncover. Another word for this is flourishing. How do human beings flourish? And that's actually the title of a recent book. Some of you may have seen it or read it. Martin Seligman. Flourishing was written by the head of the and founder of the American Positive Psychology Association. A plethora of research has since it was established 20 years, a plethora of research has been devoted to defining and measuring what it is that helps us be positive in life. How do we find the good life? I would submit that religion, this fellowship here, has the same intention, helping us to find the good life. So regarding this idea of balancing, researchers have been working not just to qualify or describe what it is that makes the good life, but in fact, to quantify it, which I think is really kind of a daunting task. But it does go back to, I don't know if you read the sermon description I said years ago, I'd heard that it takes something like 20 nice compliments to overcome one criticism. Now, I don't know that that fact or figure was ever researched, but gosh darn it, it looks like that's what these positivity researchers have been doing, exactly that. How many positive emotional states does one have to experience to offset or to balance the negative emotional states? Now, this is some fuzzy areas, and the people are working really hard to try to define, well, what's a positive emotional state? What's a negative emotional state? And we know, of course, that we have a lot of control over how we approach things. On the other hand, the world happens. Things happen to us. Things that we would definitely characterize as negative, right? As the Greek philosopher said, Hepatitus, is that it? Hepatitus, I can't remember his name, said, It is not what happens in life, but it is how we respond to it. And so this research, some of which I'm going to share with you, gives us an opportunity to think about how we can respond in order to create balance in our lives. In a 2009 book, the positivity researcher Barbara Fredrickson, who's actually a professor at Chapel Hill, posited that there is a mathematical ratio that we should be aiming for. What really caught my attention in the book was this golden ratio. She claimed that multiple studies point to that golden ratio being not 20 to 1, but 3 to 1. That is, on average, if you can manage a true, authentic, positive state for around 3 times for every 1 negative state, then you are crossing into a positive tipping point. And from that tipping point, you are likely to create a virtuous upward spiral that will assist with not only your mental health, but that of those around you. Creating more happiness will allow the floodgates of your creativity to open up, will allow you to be a better problem solver. If, unhappily, you stay below the 3 to 1 ratio, you'll get by. More concernedly, if you go down into the 1 to 1 ratio, that is, only having 1 positive emotional state for every 1 negative state, you might be at risk of feeling stuck. Feelings will not flow. Your cognition gets stymied. You become poor at actually answering mathematical questions. You might even become clinically depressed. Now, I'm not expecting you to believe me based on what I've just said, but you can actually go online and go to Fredrickson's website and take her little positivity test to find out just where you might fall in terms of the ratio. I did it twice in the last year, and I was very concerned to find that my own ratio is about 2 to 1. I'm getting by, but I'm not perhaps flourishing like I would like to be. I'm sure sometimes I am. Maybe those were just bad days when I took the test. The thing that makes me a little comfort is, well, that's where most of America is too. That's the average. 2 to 1. But wait, we say. Life is really difficult. We can't control what happens to us. Well, that's absolutely true. But back to Epictetus. It's not what life throws at us, but how we respond. And what's important to remember in terms of a strategy for possibly upping that sense of positivity is that we can, in many ways, decide what it is we're going to pay attention to. I mean, what we often forget in this age of 24-hour news that's hooking our attention, that's got commentators arguing about who's wrong, who is most wrong and what is most wrong, is really we have an opportunity to stack the deck in our favor by choosing what we pay attention to. We were assisted a few minutes ago, as Arroyo shared with us, this beautiful piece written by a fireside in Japan. And then we further delved in and thought about our own experience of a warm and comforting fire. I'd like to think that that brought most of us into a passing positive mental state. We have opportunities to do this, and of course those of you that have practices, yoga, meditation, mindfulness, that's exactly what that's aimed at doing. And yet, perhaps we could use some more motivation to bring ourselves into these positive states. Going back to the research, when we are feeling positive, we become open. This is what Barbara Fredrickson calls broaden and building. Our actual peripheral vision, what we notice, becomes wider when we are in a positive state. We have a better ability to solve problems, not just math, but that researchers will put students in a positive state of mind and then give them little puzzles to solve. And they'll do much better on those puzzles than the students who were shown pictures of something very negative beforehand. The sermon is not an argument for cat videos, but perhaps there's a place for these in our world. Once we have broadened our perspective and become more open, then we can see possibilities that theretofore may have eluded us. This is very important as a counterbalance to those times when we might feel stuck and worried and heavy and feel that there is no way out. Could it be that our brains are really just tricking us? And we could trick ourselves back a little bit. I hope I'm being clear about this. To reiterate about the type of example that researchers have created, groups of students have been shown photographs. One group was shown photographs of smiling, positive faces with landscapes and puppies. Another group was shown scenes of violence, angry expressions, starving children. And then both groups were asked to take a simple math test. Repeatedly, researchers have found that the group exposed to the positive images performed consistently better at the problem solving. It's the experiments such as this that led Martin Seligman, this father of modern positive psychology, to opine that a positive mood will buoy people into a way of thinking that is creative, tolerant, constructive, generous, undefensive. And this way of thinking aims to detect not what is wrong, but what is right. It probably even occurs in a different part of the brain and has a different neurochemistry altogether from the thinking that we produce when we are in a negative mood. Now, most of us probably have considerable skill in creating these moods for ourselves. I mentioned meditation and yoga. There's also being in nature. There's doing good for other people. There's coming to be with your religious community of a Sunday morning. One of the practices that has shown to move people the most on the positivity scale is simply that of gratitude. Yes, we should be grateful because we have things to be grateful for, but we should be grateful because it's a wonderful way to help rebalance our positive and negative mental states. Because when we are in a place of gratitude, it takes our focus away from the places where we might feel we have less to be grateful for. After the service, when we have our discussion time, I hope that you'll share with each other and with me what some of your strategies are for putting yourself into a positive mindset. Now, why is it that this might be the case? And some of you, me even, when I first encountered this research, feeling a little skeptical, thought, well, this is pretty Pollyanna. Sure, it's good to feel good. But why have I come to think that this is so important, and how was I convinced? Well, I was convinced because I'm a heady person, and there is a lot of science to back this up. It does echo what our religious forebears and ancients told us in many ways, but I like having the science. I find it comforting. But there's a lot of back and forth on this. Some people think, well, wait a minute, that golden ratio isn't 3-1. Okay, so it's not 3-to-1. Maybe I don't know exactly where, how much positivity I need in my life. And I think we could all agree that there is a case to be made. We can't have too much. We can't force ourselves to be positive or create too much positivity. We have too much positivity, which it's been theorized is about 11-to-1. If you have too much positivity, that puts you in the realm of mania. It also could put you in the realm of no action. Obviously, there are things we want to change and improve and make better in this world. And at some point, if you're so positive you can't see any of that, then you become complacent. That's not what I'm talking about here. The other interesting thing that has come to light during these decades of research about positivity is our theories about why this would be the case. Why would we develop positivity and negative states of mind that we react to so differently? What's the survival mechanism we need here that's going on? And it turns out one of the strongest theories is that negativity is how we coped with urgent, life-threatening things right in front of our face. Fight or flight. You have to react because your life is threatened. That's not a time for thinking, well, maybe that tiger's really not so dangerous and look how cute it is. That's a time for interpreting threat and moving on. But during times of relative safety, perhaps that's the time for planning, for thinking about what could be, for thinking about how you might better store the food for next season, for painting a vision of where the tribe should move to. And so it's thought that during our times of relative safety, we developed a way of thinking that would help us expand our horizons and improve ourselves, improve the lot of our families and our communities. For those of us in the world today with relative privilege, what possibilities can we find? And now I want to get into this part about the transformation and the need for a positivity revolution. As Unitarian Universalists, we're all about creating a better world, are we not? And yet, sometimes I wonder if we don't get caught or haven't gotten caught in a negative spiral. And this is a danger to those of us who would like to see a better world, because we see the problems. We see so many needs. We feel it. We're angry at injustice. We're angry about oppression. We're angry about unkindness. And perhaps this is as it should be, and it is justified. And yet, when we stay in that place, we shut down our ability to make it change. I would like to invite us as Unitarian Universalists to be part of the positivity revolution in this world, to start reminding one another again of the beauty and wonder that we find here. And not only the beauty and the wonder and what is going right, but the pieces of beauty and the pieces of strength and the pieces of resilience that we can find in almost every dire and difficult situation. It is for us to remind each other about this. I had an interesting thing happen driving in this morning. I don't know if anybody else was listening to NPR, and they had an author there who recently wrote a book about people in Syria. She followed several people for 6 years during the Syrian civil war. And certainly that's one of the more dire situations I can think of going on our planet today. And she told us, she said, right before I came in for my interview today, I talked with one of my subjects that I've been following, and he just has the most amazing attitude. I can't get it over it. His factory was recently bombed, a factory that's so important for creating economic goods and output and jobs in this war-torn economy. His factory was bombed and discouraged. And you know what he said to me? He told me, don't worry. I'm going to rebuild. But in the meantime, I've got my sights on another location that I can rent. And I thought, my gosh, if someone who's gone through that can put himself in a place of what's next, what can I create, what can I recreate, how can I rebalance, then surely we as Unitarian Universalists, those of us at least in a place of relative peace and lack of crisis right now, should be able to do the same. I know many of us these days feel a sense of hopelessness. We watch that news. We know what's going on in our government. It's really daunting. But I submit to you that now is the perfect time. Now is the perfect time to rise up and not be standing around reminding each other, reminding the world about what is so wrong, but to be mindful and look closely and find those things that are right and pay attention to them. Pay attention to them so that other people, that this will ripple out and other people will feel this opening. We can do this in how we approach other human beings. One of the practices that is called for in an age of positivity is to think about, why did somebody get to thinking that way? So quickly, we judge others, perhaps with good reason. We know there's a lot of evil going on in this world, oppressions, racism, sexism, etc., etc. But what if for a moment we were able to step back and look at people and wonder and realize that their isms are not all that they are? And what if we merely ask the question, tell me how you came to think this way? Tell me about your life and your background. That ratio of criticism to good feeling comes into play in that too. Because think about how you feel when you are criticized. I submit that we are not going to effectively change the world by criticizing those with whom we disagree. Much as I would like to, much as it feels good, we will effectively change the world by coming together with them to focus on things that we agree with. If we are a people of faith and hope, I think it becomes our responsibility to milk these fruits of positive psychology for everything that's worth, because the world really needs us. As Howard Thurman once said, the world needs you to come alive. So what is it that puts you in that positive state? As a researcher, the Czech researcher Csikszentmihalyi said, what is it that puts you in flow? Because when you are in flow is where you will increase your problem solving, your kindness, your compassion. And that in turn will transform our world. One of the practices that I'm really excited that I'm learning more about that I think can help us in this is something called appreciative inquiry. Something, anybody heard of that term? Appreciative inquiry, right. It was developed in a business school to help organizations with change. And just briefly, the history of it as an illustration, This bright, plucky PhD student went to do some interviews at the Cleveland Clinic, and he found, wow, he took his research back, he interviewed all these people, he went back to his professor and he said, wow, there's a lot, it really sucks here. It's really bad. And the professor looked over his data with them, looked at their questions, and then he looked at his young attaché and said, David, sure, you've uncovered a lot of stuff, but what were the questions you were asking? The Cleveland Clinic is known as one of the best healthcare clinics in the world. It has a success rate of da-da-da-da-da, whatever. What is it that you said to these people that made them react so negatively? And with that, appreciative inquiry was born. He reformulated his questions to uncover the positive, to uncover not what was not working, but what was working. Recently, I took a training to become an appreciative inquiry facilitator, and I've learned that there are hundreds of thousands of people all over the world now being trained in this modality to work with groups and organizations to discover what is it that is working. It's fascinating. This summer, I hope to attend the World Positive Education Summit, or actually it's called the Positive Education Accelerator, and the idea is to help empower teachers and administrators to be more positive in their approach with children, to teach children positive skills so that they, in turn, can create this better balance of thinking that will allow them to be more creative, to approach their education more responsibly, to be happier, to solve problems. And I want to spark a positivity revolution in Unitarian Universalism. What if in Unitarian Universalism we started asking the questions about what is working in our world? We who know so well what is not working. What if instead of pointing the finger at others, and often pointing the finger at ourselves, and that's a whole nother sermon about self-compassion, what if we upheld what is right? What is right in religion? Those of us who have been hurt by other forms of religion come here as refugees, understandably so. And yet certainly in some traditions, somewhere, we know of things that are amazing and empower people and work. What is right with them? And this is something that Unitarian Universalism has long sought to do. I want to re-spark that. What's great in Islam? What's wonderful in Buddhism? What's amazingly empowering about humanism? And what are the lessons that we can carry forward into the future from Christianity? Let's put our focus there. What if we seek to create a more peaceable and more understanding world, what if we asked one another, what is working in race relations? What if we look for the examples where people are getting along peacefully, where people of different cultures are working side by side? What if we asked one another simply, what is happening when you are enjoying another person's company who is different from yourself? I think these are important questions for us to be asking, because when other people hear these questions, they in turn will go back to that experience of positivity. And hopefully, let me find that reading. I took it from Ron. We will fall out of this habit of trying to convince others to believe what we believe. It won't do either of us any good. Hopefully, this will lead us to a place of wonder. The place of wonder where we can operate most optimally from as human beings. And truly live up to our destiny as being the stuff of stars. Wow. Look at what this group is doing. Look at what these amazing people are doing. Look around at one another and be in awe of human possibility again. Because, as Fred Lamont says, if you share some hint of your wonder, just a moment of your joy, and a whisper of your love, my heart might expand, awareness awaken, and the whole world could change in an instant.